And you have to have a disclaimer.
I'll say it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excuse me, Joy? No, leave it open in case people come. Can people see the slides okay in terms of the contrast? I really appreciate everybody coming today for our Peace Caucus discussion on the issues of still what we regard as the significant threat of a war in Iran, probably underscored by events of the recent days. I'll get a little more detail on this in terms of the U.S. attack in Syria, which may well presage possible attacks over the next number of months. But what I was going to attempt to do is before Dr. Parsi, who has a great deal of expertise on the Iranian situation, is to frame some of these issues in terms of our concerns from Physicians for Social Responsibility of issues of the larger framework of nuclear weapons and what I would submit is a rather hypocritical policy on the part of the United States, remaining the largest nuclear capable power in the world, and to deal with issues of nuclear proliferation, which have raised their head in terms of the situation in Iran. So the title of my talk is If You Like War in Iraq, You'll Love War in Iran, just in terms of those parallels. And this has been an issue that's been very somewhat controversial within the American Public Health Association, but initiatives and policy initiatives that Dr. Victor Seidel and I introduced over the last 2 years did put the American Public Health Association, firmly in support for ending the war in Iraq and beginning to withdraw troops from there. And last year, the resolution that was passed in opposition to a U.S. attack on Iran. So these issues are certainly within the domain of APHA concerns. Just before I start, just to make it perfectly clear, I have no financial or other conflicts in regard to these issues, although I am a member, past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. That is one of many organizations who has taken a very strong position against going to war in Iran. So I'll get started. Do I hit the red button? Or?
I think you can just click.
You know, I'll just do it manually. Okay. Yeah. Excuse me a second. Okay, so just to introduce Physicians for Social Responsibility, I mentioned a former president of our national organization in 2003. Our organization consists of 30,000 physicians and health providers around the country. The San Francisco Bay Area chapter, of which I'm president, has a membership of about 3,000. And our overall mission, which frames this discussion, is that guided by the values of the expertise in medicine and public health, PSR works to protect human life from the gravest threats to health and survival. And I'll start just by, again, framing what many of our central issues are. Much of the information that I'll be providing you, particularly around the issues of the dangers of nuclear conflict, derived from books such as War and Public Health. The latest edition came out this year. The editors are Barry Levy and Vic Seidel, two former presidents of the American Public Health Association, and Patrice Sutton and I are the co-authors of the chapter in this book on the public health effects of nuclear weapons. And it is nuclear weapons and the potential for nuclear war that frames the historical concerns of Physicians for Social Responsibility, particularly when we look at the devastation that can occur from a nuclear conflict, as evidenced by the experience of the approximately 210,000 human beings who died from heat blast and radiation from the twin explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Our organization, PSR, was founded in the early 1960s, and our original leaders of PSR collaborated on very significant series of articles in the New England Journal of Medicine, The Medical Consequences of Thermonuclear War, which cataloged what the impacts, health and environmental and public health impacts of a thermonuclear war would be. at the time when we were in the midst of the Cold War and the significant arsenals of the former Soviet Union and the United States. The conclusion of these articles that we simply would not have the ability to deal with the after effects of a nuclear conflict. We don't have enough burn beds in the country. Many physicians and other health providers would be decimated in it. And what the theme of these articles and what has remained a central moral and ethical imperative of those of us in PSR is that we needed to step beyond the conventional framework of treating illness in such instances. We needed to intervene politically as a primary public health objective of preventing any such conflict from occurring. And we firmly rejected that there was any real role for evacuation or the typical civil defense measures that were advocated throughout the 1950s and 1960s, again, that we had to act to prevent such a conflict from happening. It was efforts such as these that led to PSR being as the national U.S. affiliate of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War to share in the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. And on the right-hand side are some of the original leaders in receiving the prize in Oslo in 1985, Jack Geiger on the left, Vic Seidel in the center, and Sid Alexander on the right, all whom remain very active within our organization. And despite the fact that we had these gains and that we had a lot of these efforts in the early days culminated in the cessation of testing nuclear weapons above ground, the world has remained with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons ready to be fired, really threatening us and the rest of the world. It's remarkable in this sense to reflect upon the comments, I've shown this before in other venues, of Phyllis Schlafly, a noted right-wing spokesperson in the United States, cited in the New York Times in 1982 that the atomic bomb is a marvelous gift that was given to our country by a wise God. And we certainly understand, as I've illustrated just previously, the real horror of what nuclear conflict represents. But on the other aspect, and what the United States has shown to the rest of the world, that nuclear weapons have remained in many ways an indispensable aspect of our military and foreign policy, because it's really provided the United States, and this has been the unfortunate lesson sent to the rest of the world, with the nuclear, what we regard as a nuclear umbrella, to a wide variety of military interventions that you could see on direct interventions and what we would call proxy interventions on the right side, these covering those up to the early 1990s. And a lot of this has been really reflected in U.S. geopolitical interests in terms of, as Alan Greenspan reflected on a number of months ago, the real central desire, as underscored by current conflicts in the Middle East, to control the supplies of oil in the Middle East. Much of this information, as indicated here, very well delineated in Michael Clare's work, particularly his book Blood and Oil that came out a number of years ago. And this relationship was solidified in the post-World War II period, particularly through our relationship with Saudi Arabia, carried on through multiple U.S. administrations, and the Carlyle Group has been a very significant actor in terms of representing many ex-presidents, ex-secretaries of defense, etc., who've collaborated in developing relationships for profit with many of the leaders in the Middle East to keep the cycle of oil flowing to the United States and the corresponding cycle of arms to the Middle East in terms of a petrodollar for arms circuit. And a lot of this has involved the support of what I would regard as friendly dictators throughout who ensured that this relationship remained solid. This picture was published just a few weeks ago, showing Henry Kissinger on the left and the Shah of Iran on the right, and the corresponding very famous picture by now in terms of the well-documented handshake between Donald Rumsfeld and Saddam Hussein. And that particular set of relationships and the importance for us to at oftentimes divide and rule the Middle East has led to the flooding of the area of arms that's persisted to this date in terms of arming dictatorships. More recently in the New York Times, just to bring us up more to date, this map indicates the continuation of these policies in terms of the Caspian region and many of the former Soviet Socialist Republics, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, have been integrated into these relationships, particularly with NATO expansion. And more recently, in the New York Times, published the latest figures on the marked expansion of U.S. arming the world, basically doubled over the last 4 years. And you could see in these circled areas how much of this is involved with flooding the Middle East with arms. And these early, the earlier part of our history in terms of these relations is reflected in the Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988, half to 1 million people killed, 1 to 2 million people wounded, 2.5 million people uprooted, which in many ways sets the stage for what we currently see in terms of the real debacle of our policies in Iraq and what we hope to prevent an expansion of this misfortunate type of policy into and preventing a war on Iran. We certainly, in terms of thinking what the consequences of the prior wars have been, we could see these reports in terms of the Iraqi deaths directly due to the 1991 Gulf War, over 100,000 military deaths, and you can go down the line that the total of, and this is just from the war itself, the military actions, anywhere from 142 to 206,000 deaths. And certainly in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, American policy has really intensified in the region with a foreign policy that even The Lancet, significant British medical journal, commented on as a significant international public health issue, the dangerous rise of American exceptionalism, which has really accentuated these policies under our current administration, which has been fused by a particularly crusading impulse and has been motivated by many significant actors in American foreign policy, particularly right-wing neoconservative influences aggregated under the Project for a New American Century, here illustrated by prominent pundit William Kristol, publisher of the Weekly Standard, which has been a key linchpin in putting out a media perspective in support of these types of policies. And here is the Weekly Standard. Either fortunate or unfortunate to have a subscription to keep up on the latest developments. And William Kristol's father, Irving Kristol, one of the deans of American neoconservative thinking, pretty much put what the linchpin of these policies have been, that behind all of this is a fact, the incredible military superiority of the United States vis-a-vis the nations of the rest of the world in any imaginable combination, which really, again, sends a profound lesson to the rest of the world in terms of what really matters is military might. So if we're thinking about other countries trying to counter that or try to equilibrate, these are the sort of situation that we set up. We certainly know what the impact of this has been in terms of Iraq as of 1996 due to the excellent work of Les Roberts and Richard Garfield and others in The Lancet, that as of July 2006, 654,000 excess Iraqi deaths as a consequence of the war, about 2.5% of the population in the study area, and of post-invasion deaths, about 600,000 of these, again, as of 2006, were due to violence, the most common cause being gunfire. We have completely destroyed this society, and again, it really illustrates our need to prevent any such thing happening in terms of expanding the war to Iran or other areas in the region. We're certainly very concerned about the statements from both political parties in the current election cycle about expanding the conflict into Afghanistan. Already has caused a significant amount of destruction there, and as we're aware of the plans to expand already being undertaken in Pakistan. All of this has led to a significant budgetary crisis for us now and in the future, reinforcing the current fiscal crisis, as noted experts have indicated in the $3 trillion war. This is what we're facing, the expectation. And how are we going to have the money to be able to transfer to sustainable fuels to avoid these types of fossil fuel conflicts, or pay for the many things that Americans and people all over the world need in terms of health care, et cetera. So it's our concerns because of this trajectory of these policies and even the uncertainties that remain for the rest of this administration is whether these types of policies will lead to a conflict in Iran, certainly underscored by many articles in the media over the last number of years. This is from 2006. Maybe things will change. I'll certainly be interested in what Dr. Parsi thinks in terms of the latest developments. But as many articles came out from Seymour Hersh and others in The New Yorker, really said that a lot of our policies are really being formulated for anticipating taking out alleged Iraqi nuclear weapons capable, Iranian capable nuclear weapons site. Our organization has tried to do as much as we can to raise concerns within the medical and public health community, whether from our national office or through various chapters around the country, taking out ads like this, in terms of which provided the title for my talk. This is an example of some of the work, this in terms of our Boston chapter in collaboration with Peace Action. And last year had a major report, which is accessible on our website. I'll be leaving up the information at the end, www.psr.org, really advocating that the solution to these issues is certainly not to go to war in Iran. And we've carried these types of policies, as indicated before, here in APHA as well, and really appreciate the support that the organization gave to taking the standpoint of the oldest and largest public health association against going to war in Iran. And again, this is yet another more recent document that we've produced. So when we're thinking about this and we're making all these allegations about the dangers of Iran possessing a nuclear weapon, et cetera, we do indeed need to put this within the perspective of our own policy. Our government has certainly made a significant stand in terms of underscoring the importance of nuclear weapons with our own nuclear weapons posture review that asserted a permanent role for nuclear weapons in our military policy far into the future, proposed the use of nuclear weapons after biological or chemical attacks, all these in being breach of international law. We've proceeded with developing all sorts of nuclear weapons, tiny nukes or mini nukes that actually would have more capability to be used in battlefield situations, again illustrating the military utility of such weapons. We also had a major program, the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, that was designed for bunker busting, that it would bury beneath many stories to take out alleged nuclear sites or hardened biological chemical weapon sites. But the physics of this really didn't work out. As you could see on the right side, it's meant to bury deep beneath the surface and was being packaged as no problem. You know, you could take out these sites, the civilian population would not get damaged. In fact, leading physicists actually analyzed this and said that these weapons would go no more than maybe about 10 feet below the surface, so actually it would cause more radioactive fallout than an air burst or a near ground burst and actually contaminate much larger regions. And as a result of those type of studies, PSR used Department of Defense and Department of Energy's own data in a report back in May 2005, projecting what the casualties would be from one nuclear weapon of this sort, which is 80 times the explosive force of the weapon that was used in Hiroshima, in terms of what those impacts would be, and developed graphs like this. Again, this would be one weapon to attack the putative nuclear weapons design facility in Isfahan. And what we projected using this data is that if one of those weapons, the robust nuclear earth penetrators, were used, there would be 3 million immediate deaths, and the radioactive plume would cause significant radiation to 35 million people in Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, and India, including the 20,000 U.S. Armed Forces personnel who were stationed in Afghanistan at the time. As a result of our efforts and many of our fraternal organizations, this particular weapon was zeroed out of the budget, which was a major victory for us back in 2005. But nonetheless, the United States came back, again setting a beacon for the rest of the world in terms of nuclear weapons, developing a new weapons program the reliable replacement warhead that's projected to cost billions of dollars so we can continue to build nuclear weapons for yet another century. Again, illustrating the example that we're setting for the rest of the world. So, I mean, our lesson or our message is really is that this is insane. If we want to be talking to the Iranians or other countries around the world and curbing nuclear proliferation, we really should adhere to many of the guidelines that have been set out. For example, like organizations like the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission that issued their report back in 2006 that really underscored the fact that these major points, as long as any state has nuclear weapons, others will want them. As long as any such weapons remain, there's a risk they'll one day be used by design or accident, and any such use would be catastrophic, and we should really be thinking about abolishing nuclear weapons. And it's not just the weapons programs that we have to think about. We have to think about all of the push right now to promote nuclear power plants around the world, McCain's program, you know, build 45 new nuclear power plants as a jobs program, whatever. There are other ways to deal with the climate change than perpetuating the type of technology and as well as the development of scientific know-how and cadre to build nuclear weapons because of the perpetuation of fissile materials like plutonium from such operations that can lead to horizontal proliferation, the extension of nuclear weapons to new states. We certainly have examples if we think about the programs under Pakistan's Dr. Khan, who basically had a nuclear weapons program for hire. This is his own brochure that's been implicated in the nuclear weapons program of North Korea and is underscores much of the proliferation dangers in Iran itself. This is a picture at the time when the Iranians were celebrating the success of their centrifuge program. It's interesting in this, while we demonize the Iranians in this case for possibly following in our own steps, if we look back at our own history, we were certainly promoting the promotion of this technology back in the 1970s with this ad that was put out to send nuclear power plants to the Shah of Iran at the time. But we often don't, we often forget this history just as we forget the fact that we overthrew the democratic leader of Iran in 1953, Dr. Mossadegh. And we continue this type of hypocritical policy in the recently signed U.S.-India nuclear program, where India, as opposed to Iran, which is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, has been given the license to have advanced nuclear technology, which would, in effect, free up their ability to continue their own nuclear weapons program. So these are things that are not well known to the American people. This didn't get much attention, was rushed through over the last few months. But these are the sorts of policies that we need to think about before we're going to try to resolve the proliferation issues of Iran by going to war. So coming back to the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, the real recommendations that we should be looking at as a global community is to strengthen disarmament and non-proliferation measures as a way to getting to outlaw nuclear weapons, a whole range of comprehensive programs to strengthen our non-proliferation treaty commitments to move towards nuclear abolition with the rest of the nuclear weapon states, et cetera. Unfortunately, there remains some pushback of these types of approaches, and I want to reference that there was a major report that was issued at the beginning of this year towards a grand strategy in an uncertain world, authored by a number of ex-NATO officials that raise, again, an alarming support for the utility of nuclear weapons when we should be moving towards abolition. This is just one citation from page 90 or so that reifies the long-standing U.S. attitude towards nuclear weapons as being useful in the concept of escalation dominance, which could briefly be summed up as Paul Nitze, dean of the U.S. policy, said in the late 1940s at the time, escalation dominance represented at every level of violence, you always maintain the upper level of violence, and nothing is more violent in that sense than continuing to have nuclear weapons. And as these generals just put out, nuclear weapons remain indispensable, nuclear escalation continues to remain an element of any modern strategy. So these are the challenges that we have to overcome. We have had a little bit of breakthrough over the last few years. Some of the deans of the same Cold War policy have begun to speak out with what they regard as the folly of such policies in terms of how they destabilize the world. of this editorial in the op-ed in the Washington Post from George Shultz, William Perry, Henry Kissinger, and Sam Nunn, and followed up at the beginning of this year in the Wall Street Journal Towards a Nuclear-Free World by the same authors. And this list indicates the numerous, as it came out in the Eliminators from Joseph Cirincione and Alexandra Bell, of the former cabinet members to support the elimination of nuclear weapons. So there remains cleavage within those who rule, and we need to really support those initiatives and use these divisions, if you will, to move our campaign of abolition forward. Many organizations also early this year, Federation of American Scientists, National Resources Defense Council, and Union of Concerned Scientists came out, again, with a concrete way to reduce nuclear weapons that pretty much mirror in their steps those that the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission illustrated. Our international affiliate, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, has supported and initiated a global program, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, in documents such as this. And this really underscores our role as physicians and health professionals to really take the lead, not put our heads in the sand, but to take exert real moral and ethical leadership to end the scourge of nuclear weapons. PSR itself has instituted a campaign, Prescription for a Secure and Healthy World, which combines our concern about nuclear weapons and ending a nuclear arms race with the same parallel efforts to stop the scourge of global warming, and in such reduce the dangers of warming at the same time while we reduce the dependence on fossil fuels that produce many of these conflicts. And we've been getting many medical school and public health school deans, as well as our student chapters, to carry this out. I'll just close on this statement. We need to really think again about nuclear abolition. Joseph Rothblatt, who won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years before he passed away in 2004, spoke to our joint PSR-IPPNW meeting in Washington, D.C., saying the following: "A colossal effort will be required, the courage and the will to embark on this great task to restore sanity in our policies, humanity in our actions, and a sense of belonging to the human race." And that's what we really think we need to do. These are the steps. This is what we should be focusing on, not starting up another horrendous conflict in Iran. So thank you for coming, and I really look forward to Dr. Parsi's comments.
So I am going to now very gratefully introduce Dr. Parsi. And Dr. Parsi is here really with the support of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and we also would like to thank PSR for that. Dr. Parsi is the author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. That's Yale University Press, 2007. As soon as this is over, you might want to get a copy. The book was the 2008 Silver Medal recipient of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Arthur Ross Book Award. Dr. Parsi wrote his doctoral thesis on Israeli-Iranian relations under Professor Francis Fukuyama and Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, R.K. Ramazani, Jakub, I should have read this before I had to pronounce it, Gragiel, and Charles Duran at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Treacherous Alliance is the first book directly addressing Israeli-Iranian relations and their impact on the U.S. national interest since 1987. It is the only book based on extensive interviews with decision makers from all three countries. Dr. Parsi has conducted more than 130 interviews with senior Israeli, Iranian, and American decision makers in all three countries, and he is fluent in Persian and Farsi. He is regularly consulted by Western, Middle Eastern, and Asian governments on Middle Eastern affairs, has served as an adjunct professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins, and he's followed Middle Eastern politics for more than a decade, both through work in the field and through extensive experience on Capitol Hill and at the United Nations. He's a frequent commentator on Middle Eastern affairs and has appeared widely in the media, including BBC World News, PBS, CNN, and many, many others. And he served as an advisor to Congressional Bob Ney, on Middle Eastern issues and is a co-founder of the current president of the National Iranian American Council, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization promoting Iranian American participation in American civic life. Dr. Parsi has worked for the Swedish Parliament, the Swedish Permanent Mission to the United Nations in New York, where he served in the Security Council, handling affairs of Afghanistan, Iraq, Tajikistan, and Western Sahara, and the General Assembly's Third Committee addressing human rights in Iran, Afghanistan, Myanmar, and Iraq. He was born in Iran and grew up in Sweden. He has a master's degree in international relations and a second master's degree in economics at the Stockholm School of Economics and a PhD in international relations from Johns Hopkins. So I think he's duly qualified to speak, and we really appreciate your being here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. It's a great, great pleasure to be here today. Obviously, I wish we would be speaking about a more joyful topic, but unfortunately, things are the way they are. I want to address not only the issue of the risk of nuclear weapons in Iran, as well as the strategies that would be most successful in ensuring that that scenario would not happen while at the same time avoiding war. Before going in there, though, I want to talk a little bit about the historical context in which all of this is taking place. And I think it's important because when you watch the news today and when you watch TV or you even read the newspapers, these discussions are taking place almost in a historical vacuum. There's no context whatsoever. And oftentimes that leads us to conclusions that are not only wrong, they're counterproductive. We are oftentimes presented with a picture in which the conflict between the United States and Iran or Israel and Iran is presented as an ideological battle. It is a conflict between democracies and tyrannies. It's a conflict between secularism or fundamentalism. And these type of simplifications oftentimes come at the expense of a more nuanced understanding that actually enables us to understand the root causes of these conflicts and be able to resolve them. If these conflicts truly were of an ideological nature, we would not have seen a lot of the different diplomatic maneuvering that actually have been taking place in the last couple of decades. And I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. Let me actually give you a quote. "Iran is Israel's best friend, and we do not intend to change our position in relation to Tehran." This is a quote from an Israeli prime minister. It's not from Golda Meir in the 60s, or Ben-Gurion in the 60s, or Golda Meir in the 70s. Actually, Yitzhak Rabin, 1987. Khomeini was still alive, and he was using a rhetoric that was far more aggressive than the one used by Ahmadinejad today. Yet, Rabin referred to Iran not only as a strategic ally, but Israel was throughout the 1980s working behind the scenes with the Iranians, lobbying Washington not only to talk to Iran, but also to sell arms to Iran, and not to pay attention to Iranian rhetoric because the rhetoric was not reflective of the actual policies of Iran. Now, I won't go into further detail on that. You have to read the book to understand why that was taking place. But the essence is that behind the scenes, you're seeing completely different realities of what you're hearing in the headline news. You've seen a significant amount of outreach between all three countries trying to find a way to be able to resolve their conflicts. You had in 1996, Netanyahu trying to reach out to the Iranians extensively. He failed. During the Clinton years, even though President Clinton was the one who imposed most of the sanctions that currently exist on Iran, towards the last 2 years of his reign, he did quite a lot to try to find a way to start a dialogue with the Iranians. It was then the Iranians who were not willing to play ball. In fact, at one point at the UN Millennium Summit in 2000, President Khatami, the more moderate president of Iran, was there, as was Clinton. And Khatami's big task was to make sure that he avoided all the big hallways anywhere that he accidentally could run into President Clinton, because he could not afford to have any photographer take a picture of him shaking President Clinton's hand. I want to say this because it's important to understand that the last 8 years in which the United States has been very adamant about not pursuing diplomacy, is not has often given us the impression that it's always been the U.S. that has not been willing to talk. It's a little bit more complicated than that. There's been numerous instances in which the U.S. also has pursued dialogue, but it has not worked. The most important outreach, though, the one I think that gives us a window into understanding of how this conflict actually can be resolved, happened in 2003, May of that year. On May 3rd, the Swiss ambassador to Tehran, who had been tasked by the United States since 1991 to be the official go-between between the two governments, handed over to the State Department a negotiation proposal from the Iranian government to the Bush administration. It was a proposal that probably shocked a lot of people. I was working in Congress at the time, and we got a copy of it because my old boss used to live in Iran prior to the revolution. He was someone that was constantly briefed on developments there because he was known to be the most knowledgeable figure in Congress on Iran. And essentially what the Iranians were proposing was wide-range negotiations on everything except human rights in Iran. The Iranians offered, within the context of the negotiations, had they been successful, to end all support for Hamas and Islamic Jihad and put pressure on them not to use violence against Israel, to turn Hezbollah into a mere political organization, essentially turning him into disarming them, help stabilize Iraq, this is 2-3 weeks after the United States took Baghdad, and make sure that the government there is not a sectarian one. It's the exact same thing that the Iranians actually did successfully help the United States with in Afghanistan only about a year and a half earlier. Cooperate against all terrorist organizations, above all Al-Qaeda. This is back in the days when we actually talked about Al-Qaeda. We don't do that much anymore. Perhaps most open up the nuclear program for full transparency, and perhaps most surprisingly, to sign on to the Beirut Declaration, the Saudi peace plan that actually has been brought up into discussions again. The idea that the entire Arab world would recognize Israel in return for an Israeli recognition of a Palestinian state, which would be a formal Iranian recognition of the two-state solution, something that the Clinton administration had fought very, very hard for achieving. This was now on the table. In return, the Iranians wanted the recognition of their, what they call, legitimate defense interests in the region. They wanted access to religious sites in Iraq. They wanted an end to all U.S. sanctions on their economy and an essentially a strategic dialogue with the United States. The proposal came in May 3rd. My boss actually got a copy of it, which was delivered to the White House through Karl Rove. And that was the last thing we heard of it for a couple of weeks until in the Financial Times, 2 months or so later, there was an article saying that some sort of a peace proposal had been delivered to the United States through the Swiss, and the response of the Bush administration was to reprimand the Swiss ambassador for having delivered it in the first place. Apparently, a debate had been taking place inside the White House in which the neoconservative faction had won, and their argument was, whatever can be gained through negotiations with Tehran, even more can be gained by simply removing that government through a third war. And as a result, the Bush administration moved to make sure that any talk, any discussion about diplomatic options would essentially not be permitted. The proposal was made public a couple of years later. I had a copy of it and I gave it to a bunch of journalists. This was in spring 2006. I was personally very concerned that the risk of war was getting really, really high that spring. You saw that article that Dr. Gold put up talking about the nuclear option against Iran. That was April 2006. It's about that time that I gave the proposal to a bunch of journalists and started writing about it. Initially, the Bush administration denied it. Well, they denied that there ever was a proposal. When the proposal was starting to be published in the newspapers, they said, well, it actually wasn't an Iranian proposal, it was a Swiss proposal. And then there was a long number of various excuses that was presented. Now, part of the reason I think this is important is not to point fingers and say, well, this party did wrong, this party did wrong. there's enough guilt to go around. But what's important is to understand there actually are solutions. There are ways through diplomacy in which common ground can be found. And this is particularly important these days when you have individuals who are running around throughout the United States and elsewhere saying that it's 1938 and Iran is Germany and Ahmadinejad is Hitler. If you accept the premises of this analogy, that indeed it is 1938, Iran is Germany and Ahmadinejad is Hitler, then the question is, who would like to play the role of Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister who thought he could negotiate? This is an analogy that is deliberately designed at eliminating diplomacy from the table. If you eliminate diplomacy from the table, you make war inevitable. And don't take that from me. Take it from Nick Burns, who was the Undersecretary of State during the last 3 years of the Bush administration. He just came out 2 days ago in an article in Newsweek in which he essentially says that unless there are talks, the two countries will continue to gravitate towards a conflict. It's not just about changing presidents, etc. There needs to be a significant policy shift. Now, going to the nuclear issue, part of the reason why it's been rather difficult to be able to even consider any type of a resolution or compromise on the nuclear front is because of the fact that the position that we have taken, that we formulated over the last couple of years, we have essentially equated nuclear uranium enrichment with nuclear weapons. We have defined a nuclear weapons capability to be the real threat, not nuclear weapons, meaning that the mere knowledge of the fuel cycle in Iran we consider the same as a nuclear weapon. To be able to resolve that, then, that essentially means that we need to go to zero enrichment. There can simply not be any nuclear program in Iran. It doesn't matter if it's peaceful or not. Anything that entails enrichment, we have this defined to be a nuclear threat. It's been an utterly unsuccessful strategy. In 2003, when the Iranians gave that proposal, they had probably less, and this is probably a very optimistic assessment, less than 100 centrifuges. They had not mastered a lot of the technologies that are needed. Today, after 5 years of not negotiating, they have more than 4,000 centrifuges, and they're well on their ways of being able to fully master the fuel cycle. We need a shift in our way of looking at it, in which the bottom line no longer can be enrichment, it has to be actual bomb making. If not, that means that even in a military operation, it's not just about using bunker busters. If you truly want to eliminate the knowledge, then the United States needs to kill about 6,000 Iranian scientists. They never mentioned that out loud, but that essentially is what it is. If we are defining the threat as being nuclear know-how, then it is not sufficient just to destroy the facilities. You have to kill the scientists too. I'm pretty certain that that is going to be a policy that more and more people will agree needs to shift. And there are proposals out there, proposals that are not based on zero enrichment, but that can still meet the objective of making sure that there isn't any Iranian nuclear bomb. Because at the end of the day, we do have to be very clear on that. Nuclear weapons in Iran, just as much as nuclear weapons in any other country, is a step in the wrong direction. It's destabilizing for the region. It does not matter if other countries have it or not. There's absolutely no reason to sit idly by and see yet another country go in that direction. But there are numerous steps in which the Iranians can have a peaceful nuclear program, even have enrichment, yet not go for weaponization. There's one proposal by former Undersecretary of State Tom Pickering, in which they are giving the proposal that there would be multinational facilities in Iran, meaning that there would be facilities in which the enrichment is taking place that is co-owned and cooperated by several countries, including countries from the Middle East, in order to reduce their anxiety about the Iranian nuclear program. That would enable a situation in which the Iranians would not be able to divert any enrichment towards military usage without everyone else finding out very, very quickly, if not immediately. it would give the maximum amount of transparency and inspections in order to make sure that the international community can rest assured that the program in Iran is not moving towards weaponization. But again, in order to even be able to begin a reasonable discussion on how we can find a solution to this issue that meets both countries' bottom lines. The Iranian bottom line is enrichment on their soil. Our bottom line should be no nuclear weapons in Iran. Before that can be done, we have to redefine our objective and start talking about weapons as a problem, not know-how or capability. Otherwise, if this is set to be a precedent, then we would have to have preemptive wars against Japan, Belgium, Sweden, and a couple of other countries as well. And I'm pretty sure that's not going to be easily sold to the American public. Thank you so much.
We have plenty of time for discussion, as we hope. So you can ask questions of either speaker. Maybe we'll start out with questions for Dr. Prosti. Comments, observations? Sure. And then you.
Bob Gould started with a big display explaining how the American military is the strongest in the world and all that. That is pure bunk. It comes directly out of the 2001 Pentagon quadrennial evaluation of our military establishment. You don't lose anything in the argument if you point out that that evaluation was wrong in saying that we had a military establishment that could simultaneously fight and win two regional wars, and at the same time do all the other things it is supposed to be doing. That's nonsense. You can point out that we have a perfectly falling apart military establishment, which is unable to win a war in Iran, and the people with whom it is trying to win the war have to go back and go back and go back again. Nonsense. We don't have a military establishment, and you can point out for that reason we are not in a position to go to war, so stop making all these threats against the Iranians.
If I take your point that we've been unsuccessful and overstretched in our imperial designs, I would certainly agree with you that we could see from the last decade that we've been unsuccessful in being able to get our way in the rest of the world. I think we are indeed an empire in decline. That's been commented on by numerous people. Most recently, a number of months ago, I didn't show that slide in terms of the declining power of American military and foreign policy. But I would submit, in terms of the amount of money that we invest in our military, the amount of armed forces that we have, our nuclear stockpile, that we still continue to wreak an enormous havoc around the world, and the fact that we have a very capable nuclear arsenal that could decimate countries around the world, that's an incredible cause for alarm. Our expansion in terms of a NATO expansion to attempt through ourselves and our allies in formerly just in Western Europe, but now that it's expanded to try to safeguard oil supplies in the Caspian. These are issues that militarize the entire planet and themselves cause incredible numbers of deaths throughout the planet. So I just think that, although again, if the kernel of what you're saying is that we ain't what we would like to be in terms of our ability to project power, we maintain a very large military force spending far more than the rest of the world, the next five or six military powers combined on our armed forces.
Alleged medical problems.
Well, a lot of people hoped that he would take a very long vacation since he was so exhausted. It certainly is an issue. Certainly is a question, who is in charge? But in my view, sometimes this has been an issue that has perhaps been made a little bit more complicated than it actually needs to be. We do have an experience in dealing with the Iranians in which we know that the final word comes from the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. There is a reason why he's called the supreme leader. He's the one who has the final word on these things. And when it comes to presidents in Iran, traditionally, the institution of the presidency has been relatively weak. So the president is not in charge of the army. The president would never have his finger or any of those type of military buttons. And the president essentially cannot govern unless he has at least tacit support from the supreme leader. The problem that has taken place in the way that we have reached out in the past is that we have essentially not recognized the power structures in Iran. When President Clinton was reaching out in the late 1990s, he was excited about the fact that there was now a new president in Iran that was not using the same language and rhetoric as the previous presidents. He came across as a moderate. He was talking about the dialogue of civilizations, etc., etc. But the way the outreach was taking place made it very clear, actually it was explicit, that we were reaching out to the reformists in order to undermine and weaken the conservatives. And then we had the naive expectation that while we do that and while we say that, the conservatives would just sit there and not do anything. And of course, that's not the way it happened. The conservatives acted very forcefully to undermine any efforts to get any U.S.-Iran breakthrough because they realized that the breakthrough was aimed at isolating and weakening the conservative faction. I think by now there is an understanding in Washington that if we have the political will to actually pursue dialogue, we have to pursue a dialogue with the entire power establishment in Iran, not with the aim of weakening either side directly at least. If the Iranians were saying, we're going to talk to the U.S. because we want to make sure we weaken the Republicans in order to strengthen the Democrats, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans would be terribly happy about hearing anything of that nature. It would be completely counterproductive, and it's equally counterproductive when we're using that type of a language. Nevertheless, I personally believe that if there is what seems to be increasingly likely, a President Obama in 2009, it would be wise of him to begin by sending a communique through the Swiss again, because that's the official channel, in which he addresses not the president of Iran, but the supreme leader, and spells out a vision of where it is that the U.S. would like to go with Iran. Explain the strategic intent. We have now, for quite some time, in a lot of different arenas, pursued negotiations by saying, let's take on the easy subjects first. And once those have been cleared, then we'll go towards the tough subjects. That was the entire formula for Oslo. It did not work. What did work, however, was the way that the Israelis negotiated with the Arabs after 1973 war in Camp David, in which Moshe Dayan told Sadat, I intend to give back the Sinai. Now let's sit down and work out how we can make that happen. The strategic intent, the end goal, is first defined, and then you work away towards being able to reach that. Instead of leaving the end goal as something that is undefined, which just fuels the already existing lack of trust between the two countries, because no one knows where this process actually is going. I would advise the president to also be careful not to try to do anything with Ahmadinejad, for the simple reason that there are elections coming up in Iran in June 2009, and you don't want to do anything, accidentally or not, that may end up helping any specific candidate in that election.
I have a question about positions for social responsibility opinion in terms of people's nuclear power. In the talk that you made back before, it seems that sometimes there was of our nuclear efforts, like the whole thing of Ukraine, and the possibility of nuclear.
Well, I'll answer it in a number of ways. We are, as an organization, opposed to nuclear power, so that's a starting point. The reason for this is manifold. In terms of the nuclear proliferation issues, although I also want at the same time completely agree with what Dr. Parsi is saying, that there's a difference between having nuclear technologies and having nuclear weapons in terms of looking at what the threats are. The heart of this issue, in my opinion, and I believe PSR's opinion, is the situation that was set up under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, where it's a deal for those countries who are not nuclear weapons powers, and there originally were five, was that for other countries to forestall any desires to add to the horizontal proliferation of nuclear weapons, the spread of nuclear weapons to other countries, that there was a policy of promoting peaceful nuclear energy in the early days under the Atoms for Peace program, et cetera. I do believe, and I think we as an organization believe, that this is latent proliferation, that as long as you have nuclear power capabilities, you have the ability to generate fissile materials, you develop a scientific cadre, the very scientists that Dr. Parsi is saying that you'd have to eliminate, to truly eliminate nuclear weapons potential, not just the materials and the civilian nuclear power plants and the centrifuges itself, these capabilities remain. So in our own estimation, in order to really have a comprehensive way to end proliferation, curbing these types of programs and the materials that they create and all the rest of the cycle is important. In turning to discussing the issue of nuclear power in terms of alleviating our very significant problems on in terms of global climate change and what are the best types of technologies to have, I would cite a number of studies that have come out over the last number of years, particularly with reference to the studies that Amory Lovins and others have had at the Rocky Mountain Institute, Arjun Makajani at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research at Tacoma Park, Maryland, who recently authored a book, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, as a way to dealing with climate change. It's unquestionable that nuclear power production, at the point of production, does not release the contributing gases, the carbon dioxide that cause climate change. We do have to think about the fact that the building of nuclear power plants involves an enormous amount of concrete and other materials that use fossil fuels. The generation of nuclear fuel itself uses a great deal of fossil fuels. More importantly, studies, for example, those that came out at MIT in 2002, illustrated that, for example, if you entertained the trajectory of energy expansion around the world and tried to make up the gap with using nuclear power to keep greenhouse emissions steady, the scenario that was developed by MIT and then recapitulated by Rocky Mountain Institute and Arjun at IER, with that would require between 2010 and 2050 putting a new nuclear power plant online somewhere in the world between every 7 and 15 days. This would be an enormous expenditure in terms of what that would cost. It would mean that we would need about nine Yucca Mountain facilities. Our current slated depository at Yucca Mountain will probably not open for at least another 20 years because of major problems in terms of potential leakage into aquifers and stuff like that. And to contemplate designing nine such facilities between now and 2050 is rather daunting. We have no real way to deal with the waste, and the economic costs of such an expansion for a time when we really need to have more immediate expenditure on safe and alternative energies, these alternative technologies would be completely starved out. If we had one similar episode, and the probabilities increase with this type of massive nuclear power expansion along the lines of Chernobyl or even Three Mile Island, that program would probably stop. And at that time, we would have committed so many resources over the years that, again, our ability to deal with sustainable and alternative technologies would really be crippled. That's the reason why we think that as opposed to going along that real way of folly. We need to really redouble our efforts towards the other types of energy forms. And Arjun Makhachani, in his own book, really sketches out a way that you can begin to meld technologies that heretofore have not really had sufficient investment. But so, for example, if you have limitations in solar in terms of storing energy, you can combine technologies. And I would refer you to his book and others and how you can actually make that happen.
The risk for escalation, unfortunately, is quite great because the United States and Iran are deep inside each other's spheres of influence and we don't have any real robust channel of communication. Mistakes can happen. We've already seen a couple of very near experiences, such as what happened in the Strait of Hormuz earlier. I think it was last year or was it this year. These things are extremely dangerous. I've spoken to people in the military that are saying that don't be surprised to see the captain of that ship who did not shoot to actually be passed over a couple of times for going up the ranks, because essentially he actually did not follow the guidebook of what he should be doing. So we're in a very, very dangerous situation as long as there isn't any real conversations going. And my fear again is that because of the extensive lack of trust that exists between the two countries, that goes back to Iranian involvement in Lebanon, goes back to what happened during the revolution, goes back to 1953, but perhaps most recently what happened in 2001 in Afghanistan. Let me just give this as a parenthesis. When the United States invaded Afghanistan, we did not build a coalition to defeat the Taliban. We joined an existing coalition, a coalition that had been armed and funded by the Iranians for about 9 years, because Iran almost went to war with the Taliban in 1998. And coordination between the United States and the Iranians in Afghanistan was extremely close, both on the military end, but most importantly, on the political end. Because the Iranians had much more influence over the Northern Alliance that eventually won in Afghanistan than we did. And we needed their help and support in order to make sure that we could convince them to agree to a new constitution for Afghanistan that did not give them the entire victory. The Afghan way of winning was everything is yours, but now we needed a new constitution that was not ethnically based. And it was thanks to the Iranian help in the Bonn Conference on December 10th, 2001, in which the new constitution was put together, that the new president of Afghanistan was not a Tajik from the Northern Alliance. He was actually a Pashtun, Hamid Karzai. This was critical. This was essential. According to James Dobbins, who was the envoy of President Bush to this conference and who organizes together with the Iranians, America would never have won the peace in Afghanistan had it not been for the cooperation with Iran. 6 weeks later, after the Bonn Conference in Germany, 2001, 6 weeks later, President Bush puts Iran in the axis of evil. Tehran was shocked. The diplomats who had convinced Supreme Leader Khamenei to go along with this idea of helping the United States without exacting a price up front were completely discredited, because it essentially was seen as a free gift and they got nothing in return. And there are numerous examples that are completely vice versa. What the Iranians did not know, that the Bush administration had already adopted what was called the Hadley rules. Steve Hadley was the National Security Advisor. The idea that during the war on terror, we would cooperate tactically with any country, including the rogue states, but we would never permit the tactical cooperation, however useful it was, to translate into a new strategic relationship. So the minute we no longer needed the tactical cooperation, we would go back to the enmity that was reigning. As long as we have this as the experience, which we unfortunately do, I don't see any progress in Iraq on a tactical basis, unless it is strategic, meaning that we have to create linkages between Iraq, Afghanistan, the nuclear issue, Israel-Palestine, everything. We cannot deal with the problems we have with Iran piecemeal. We have to deal with all of them at once, because there's not going to be any willingness from any side to give anything unless it is connected to a larger picture. The Iranians are finding themselves in a rather difficult position, in the sense that on the one hand, they do not want to see this current plan be signed, which would give the United States, 40 or so different bases in Iraq. They do not want to see a permanent American presence there, in which you have American troops, as you mentioned, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The Iranians view that as a significant security threat. And part of the background, right or wrong, part of the reason why they view this is part of the reason why a lot of Iraqi Shiites are also very skeptical about this, is because of a perception, right or wrong, I'm talking about perceptions here, that the Iraq-Iran war was fought by Saddam at the behest of the United States. A lot of Iraqis view that not as an Iran-Iraqi war, but as a U.S.-Iran war in which Iraq was one of the proxies. I personally don't agree with that assessment in the way that I explained it. But it is a widely held perception in the region. And when you have that perception, that makes the idea of having permanent American bases in Iraq all the more toxic, both to Iraqi Shiites as well as to the Iranians. However, at the same time, the Iranians would be put in an even more difficult position if the United States left Iraq very quickly. The Iranians are in no position to be able to take over Iraq or become the hegemon of the region and all these kind of things that we hear hawks in Washington warn about. Iran does not have those type of offensive capabilities. In fact, part of the reason why Iran has been able to rise in power and in influence is because it is not shouldering the burden of security in the region the way that the United States is. So it's benefiting from the fact that the U.S. decided to shoot itself in the foot a couple of times. If the United States leaves and creates a vacuum that sucks in the Iranians, then that's going to be extremely problematic for them. So they're walking they're doing a balancing act right now in which they don't want a permanent American presence, nor do they want to see a very quick withdrawal because of the consequences of that. There is a somewhat similar landscape in Iran in which it would be, it's not easy for them to do this either, particularly mindful of the attempts that have been made that have not been successful. However, my own impression is that the most conservative elements are actually outside of the government and would not be able to, if Khamenei puts down his foot, which he only would do after first having created a consensus, then I see that as being the best amount of protection that the Iranians ever could expect. If you had a president that was rushing to do so without, on the Iranian side, without having Khamenei on board, then that would be much, much more problematic. But also, in regards to the American equation, it is true, there are a tremendous amount of forces, we've seen them in action just recently, that are trying to do everything they can to pigeonhole a potential president of Obama to make sure that he cannot exercise the diplomatic option. And they've been somewhat successful in some manners to be able to do so. But it is also true that this is a person that, if he is elected, was elected on a platform in which he said that he would break with past policies, said that he would negotiate with countries that we have problems with, who said that he would pursue a completely different posture in the Middle East. And one of the important consequences of that is that a lot of those elements who are within the Democratic Party who would have problems with any negotiations with Iran are going to be put in a difficult position, in the sense that they're not going to be, it's not going to be very popular to go against your own president, particularly not in the first 2 years of his presidency. I wouldn't go as far as to say that it's informed. Certainly, it is not a worldview that is necessarily enlightened. However, this is, in my view, based on my interviews and studying their actions, a government that is far more Machiavellian than ideological. This is a government that is very clever in using the ideological vehicle and instrument to advance your own interests, but in essence, behind that you have a very calculated policy with a very clear defined national interest that they are pursuing. In a way, one would think that that makes it worse, but it actually makes it much, much easier. I think by now we know how difficult it is to deal with countries that are led by ideologues. We've seen that in our own country, it makes it extremely, extremely difficult. Now, it doesn't mean that it's easy to deal with countries that pretend to be ideologues, but the fact that they are pretending is actually, in this context, a step in the right direction. To give you an example, the Iranians have a policy that they call simulated irrationality. At times, they want the outside world to think that they are ideological and irrational because of a calculation that if the outside world cannot understand how you are operating, what your motivations are, that makes you less calculable. And if you're less calculable, the outside world becomes more careful. It's in the long run, of course, a disastrous policy because it undermines any potential trust that can be built between Iran and the outside world, which at the end of the day is the essence of security. But it is, unfortunately, a tactic that is not uncommon. In fact, President Nixon pursued a very similar policy in his madman theory, in which he wanted his advisors to whisper to the Russians that Nixon was a little bit unstable in the hope that that would make the Russians more cautious. Regarding Afghanistan, I will have to pass on that. I have not been following that question close enough recently to be able to know the details of that. Sure. Yeah, I'll give a quick answer. Your first question was, you stated that the population in the Middle East actually do want the United States to leave. They don't view the occupation favorably. And you're quite right. I wasn't actually addressing the populations of Iran or any other region. I was talking essentially what the government perspective was. And even in the government, you're actually, again, quite right. Again, they don't want to see any permanent American presence. But an America that would leave immediately, very quickly, without leaving some institutions capable of upholding some level of stability, would be equally dangerous to a lot of the countries in the region. That, again, doesn't mean that they like the occupation. It just means that they're put in a very, very difficult catch-22 situation.
I hope I understood your second question because I was just a little distracted here, so please correct me if I'm wrong. What I understood your second question to be was the issues of beyond the dangers of proliferation in terms of what we call horizontal proliferation to new countries would be the issue what we call the vertical proliferation, the continued maintenance of nuclear arsenals among the original five nuclear weapon states that has proliferated to countries such as Israel and India, Pakistan, North Korea with a small arsenal to move down to zero. Yes, and again, I hope I understand your question. The non-proliferation treaty, I addressed the Article 4 issues of peaceful nuclear energy and how that could lead to new nuclear weapons powers. Absolutely, from the standpoint of the various conferences on dealing with the non-proliferation treaty over the last number of years, there was a deal that was cut in a number of conferences ago that firmly was supposed to have the current nuclear powers to have drastic reduction of their weapons under Article 6 of the non-proliferation treaty towards abolition of nuclear weapons. Those countries have completely failed to keep those obligations, as illustrated, and I'm sorry if it wasn't clear in my own presentation, as illustrated certainly by our own country's desire to have a new generation of nuclear weapons, such as the Reliable Replacement Warhead Program. These are exactly the wrong signals sent to the rest of the world, and we need to uphold our own obligations towards disarmament, towards abolition. Was that the sense of what you were getting at?
It certainly affects the equation, and it's partly because the Bush administration has had a great difficulty prioritizing what it wants to focus on and what is more important. We want maximum optimal results in everything. We want the Russians to cooperate to the level that we want in the Security Council, yet at the same time we are giving signals to the Georgians that if you were to take military action, we would come behind you, and then expect not that that would not affect how everything else is playing out elsewhere. In a way, though, Russia has probably been the greatest benefactory of this conflict for the last 5 years. Anything short of a U.S.-Iran deal and anything short of a U.S.-Iran war essentially benefits the Russians. The war talk pushes up the oil price that makes Putin very, very happy. The absence of an American participation in the negotiations increases Russia's role in this and its diplomatic profile. Our enmity with Iran pushes Iran further and further into Russia's sphere of influence against Iranian wishes. The Iranians have had about 500 years of rivalry and enmity with the Russians. They don't view the Russians positively at all, and vice versa. So this very important piece, geopolitically, we have, because of our sanctions policy, refusal to negotiate, etc., made a very low-hanging fruit for the Russians. And as a result, you're not going to see the Russians being playful. If anyone is playing for time and wanted to prolong this, it's the Russians. They're the ones who are benefiting the most.
I was going to just add a few points. I don't have that. Actually, just to go back to a slide that I had before, just to reference. This report, I think, Maureen, deals with a lot of the issues that you're raising, because what this is trying to address, in addition to what Dr. Parsi is saying, is that, and what they're advocating, is that our policy up until this point has not been comprehensive. So what they're calling for is that we need steps to sort of guarantee not only to the Russians but also to the Chinese that our policies don't stimulate proliferation. So I'll give some additional examples. We continue to have our weapons and to advocate a policy of launch on warning. As long as we have a launch on warning status, other people are going to keep their weapons launch on warning status and continue to have a buildup. So they say one of the elements towards true security is going to have to reduce that. But these steps can't be in isolation. At the same time, while we're concerned about these issues, the United States and, it's been given quite a lot of press, and partly as rationalized by the threat from Iran, is promoting the development of missile defense systems and pushing them on the Czechs and the Poles as a way that, of course, has on the one hand antagonized the Russians, but also puts countries like China in a position that up until now, as analyzed within the last 2 years, they had a major review of the elements of Chinese nuclear policy in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, whereby efforts like these to sort of protect against, supposedly, if national missile defense worked, leads to other countries to attempt to overwhelm such systems. So at this point, for example, China had kind of settled in their own way to have a nuclear force, an offensive nuclear force, somewhere between, it's been reported, 100 to 200 nuclear weapons. And what this is then tends in terms of the divisions among military and political figures in various countries, and with reference to China, there's always debates. Well, if the United States is banking on national missile defenses, if we want to maintain our ability from a deterrence standpoint, which a lot of these countries advocate, we're going to have to build new nuclear weapons. If we're now concluding a U.S.-India nuclear deal, that's going to free up Indian resources to boost their nuclear weapons. The Chinese perceive that, and they end up having more proliferation, which is, again, coming back to this report, is a very good document because it talks about all the various steps that have to be taken at once. So you have to take your weapons off alert status. You have to end this, propagation of missile defense systems, which, again, are extremely costly, benefit the Lockheed Martins, Boeing, et cetera. You need to take all of these steps in a comprehensive way, and hopefully the next administration will take that on. But unless we do that, I think you're going to get into this action-reaction pattern that's only going to lead to more likely vertical proliferation, getting back to what this gentleman was raising. Thank you. I think it's a very important question, something that we oftentimes tend to pay far too little attention to. You have a new generation in Iran who did not grow up during the time of the Shah. They only hear horror stories about it, but they actually never actually experienced it themselves. Many of them did not even grow up during the time of the Iraq-Iran war, which has been the defining experience of most of the people in the Iranian government.
It's a new generation that wants what young people all over the world wants. They want the opportunities. They want to be able to live freely. They want to be able to express themselves. They want to be able to participate in a democracy. And I think in many ways, even though right now the situation in Iran is extremely negative, you're seeing significant human rights abuses taking place. Just these weeks, you had an Iranian-American girl who was going to Iran to do a paper on the women's right movement there, who has been arrested. You have numerous examples. A lot of people are being charged without taken, but without being charged. What you're seeing is a situation in which the Iranian government has taken advantage of the tensions that exist in the region, and particularly the threat of war from the United States. They use that to securitize the atmosphere inside of Iran, in order to be able to continue with human rights abuses with far greater impunity than they could before. Because when you have a securitized atmosphere, I mean, just think back to what we had after 9/11. When everything is thought of in security terms, people pay less attention to their civil rights, to their human rights. They are more accepting of things that they intellectually disagree with, yet they accept it. And the Iranian government has taken advantage of that extensively to be able to push back the women's rights movement, the pro-democracy movement, the pro-human rights movement. I don't see that, however, being long-lasting. When you go to Iran, you see a young generation that is extremely, extremely capable and is very much aware, in a paradoxical way, I would say, if you compare the Iranian youth in Iran and the Iranian-American youth in this country, I would say you came across more people in Iran, more young people in Iran, who truly understood and had embraced the values of democracy because they had been deprived of it. Here we take it oftentimes for granted. So in that way, I think the future, nevertheless, even though it's very bleak right now, the future is bright for the younger generation in Iran. But I think it's, again, I want to emphasize this point. This is critical. You're not going to see democratization in Iran or advancement of human rights in Iran unless the geopolitical context, unless the security environment around Iran is also first improved. Because governments are very good at taking advantage of tensions on their borders in order to repress their populations at home. And unfortunately, not only due to our actions, but because of other things, there are plenty of tensions in the region, and the Iranian government is having a field day with that right now.
I just wanted you to all join me in thanking our terrific speakers, and also I wanted to say that there are two things. I also wanted to thank PSR for making Dr. Parsi's presentation here possible. I also wanted to remind you all that his book is Treacherous Alliance, 2007, Yale University Press. And I also wanted to tell you that if you like this presentation, we have a session at 4:30, and the Peace Caucus and the Labor Caucus have a session at 4:30 in the Convention Center. And there's also a session tomorrow on the Middle East, and it's From War to Poverty, and it's a long title, and I foolishly am up here without the name of it. But maybe Joy, you all have been given by Joy Marshall, from the Peace Caucus. Here it is. Thank you, Bob, for rescuing me here. It is From War to Poverty, The Impact of Violence on Health from Beirut to Baghdad, Karachi to Kabul. There's no way I could have gotten that. So that's tomorrow at 12:30, and this afternoon at 4:30, it's Labor, Peace, and Public Health, Building Alliances to End the Iraq War. So anyway, thank you all so much. I hope if you like these sessions that you'll consider joining the Peace Caucus. We really need a lot of support to continue to bring these kinds of issues to the attention of the membership here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, they make a stand up last.
Huh?
They make a stand up last.
Oh, that's okay, but I mean, I've got one. Can I look it up?
Yeah, if you can get it to work. It's just if you're going to be recording your presentation, you'll need to stand in front of a microphone so we can record your voice. But if you're not recording, then you're free to wander around.
I'm not recording for a dynamic.
Yep. Okay, you have it with you?
Yeah.
Okay, we can take care of that. All three of us will
like that.
Great. Let's make that happen.